Tonight's the second talk in the series on the Sutta, and this talk will also be in regards to the Kalama Sutta, because I really feel like the Kalama Sutta is important enough to contain several talks. In fact, I was thinking if I had just two suttas of the Buddha to read, I think this would be one of the two. And the other would probably be the Satipatthana Sutta, which is the application of mindfulness. Because I think it's so important in setting the tone of how it is that we handle and work with the world. So I just want to encourage people to read the sutta in full from the web page, if you don't have a copy. And it's on the web page. And apply yourself, if you wouldn't mind, to the subjects through the homework that was forgotten tonight. But so I just read the core of the sutta one more time. It's framed both in positive terms and in negative terms, and this one is in the negative. And of just to set the stage, the Kalamas are a clan who came to the Buddha, and they had a series of holy men and women move through their community and had listened to the different teachings, one contradictory to another, and one teacher despairing comments of another, and it was all very confusing to them. So they came to the Buddha for some sense of clarity. And the core paragraph that the Buddha says, "Of course you are uncertain, Kalamas. Of course you are in doubt. When there are reasons for doubt, uncertainty is born. So in this case, Kalamas, don't go by reports, by legends, by traditions, by scriptures, by logical conjectures, by inference, by analogies, by agreement through pondering views, by probability, or by thought. When you know for yourself that these qualities are unskillful, these qualities are blameworthy, these qualities are criticized by the wise, these qualities, when adopted and carried out, lead to harm and to suffering, then you abandon them." I don't know if you've read the sutta, but there's an interesting prologue in the sutta about the Kalamas coming to the Buddha, and some of them sitting down very reverentially and bowing, and some just kind of coming in and plunking themselves down without any deference at all. And you can see that some of them are real irritable and irritated by this whole thing. And the tone is just set for this irritability to be explored. So tonight I'd like to talk about the aspect of this teaching that talks to about our self-doubt. Our self-doubt. Because that's what the Kalamas are feeling. They don't know what's right. They're just full of doubt. "Of course you are uncertain. Of course you're in doubt," said the Buddha. And it's very troubling to them. They don't have any base of stability in themselves, and which is what self-doubt is. There's no sense of self-confidence, no groundedness of confidence. And that leads to a kind of bewilderment of just not knowing what to do and confusion. Now, all of us know what self-doubt is. I had a wave of it myself this week. I was instructed by the physical therapist that I go see to start working, gaining strength in my upper body and in my arms. So I took it to heart and went into the University of Washington IMA, which is the intramural building, in the weight room. And I walked in. And first of all, the people there were a third of my age and two or three times the size. And whoa, I am not in Kansas. And I could see, you know, that there was no leaning at all to try to posture myself to be anything other than a weakling. I certainly wasn't intimidating anyone in the building. And I remember the weights, you know, they have these big barbell weights. And so I went for the smallest little ones, and I still couldn't lift the thing, so I ended up just lifting the bar itself. And just wondering what everybody was thinking as they were putting on more and more of the weight. But there was a lot of self. I mean, I was not in my element. All of a sudden, my environment was not there. And the whole way people are in the weight room was a little bit off center for me. And I could just feel it. Well, you know, what am I doing? There was not only confusion, but a sense that, you know, maybe this isn't where I should be. But then you ground that. I mean, we have a default position. We have a fallback. Somebody who didn't would get lost in that thinking and probably leave. I didn't get lost in the thinking and I didn't leave. I just, sure, I made a fool of myself, but that's okay. But I just, you know, it doesn't matter. You just, you ground yourself where you are, and the doubting is one of the things that comes in the, okay, from the circumstances of where we are comes, but the ground doesn't let the self-doubt solidify, doesn't let it take hold, doesn't let it create a problem at all. And the problem, I think, with our culture is that we are a thought-based culture, not wisdom-based. There are some cultures that honor wisdom, like the Tibetans. And you can see that in general, not in particular, but in general, Tibetans don't have quite the neurotic tendencies that we seem to have. They have different ways that they are attached and fearful, I'm sure, but it's not quite the same inner dynamics that we have. And because we're so thought-based, and thoughts being so abstract, and they represent themselves in terms of a view. And all you need is somebody in the opposite corner questioning your view, and we don't have anything to fall back on because we have very little self-knowledge in this culture. We don't have any ground to fall back on to hold our confusion when we are questioned. And so we doubt. Oh my God, maybe I'm wrong. Now that compounded with the fact, and we just need to know what the culture does to us. So I bring this up not as a statement of counterculture, but as a statement of understanding and investigating what it is that our culture affects are upon us. And so there's a need for this culture for us to be dependent upon things. And that dependency requires a kind of leaning into, not an alignment and a erect, straight standing, groundedness. It's a kind of a leaning into. Dependency is a dependent upon something. We like to think of ourselves as being self-reliant, but really we're not. We're not a very self-reliant culture. Look at the things we need, our needs. And when those things are removed, it creates a crisis of who am I? a psychic crisis within ourselves. We lose our job, we lose our marriage, we lose this or that, and suddenly we're in a crisis of self-confidence. And perhaps many of us have experienced that. We lose somebody from death or dying because we have lived in the abstract reality, the abstract world of thought, in which things don't die, in which permanency and continuation is a given from the world of thinking, that when it actually happens, we have no ground to come, no self-knowledge to ground ourselves in. And so self-doubt is going to be a very common occurrence for most of us. Now, we come from a culture that has that already as sort of the backdrop, and then we come into a practice that takes the very things that we were dependent upon and has us question them. It says, you know, your thoughts aren't reliable. Don't depend upon your knowledge. And those are the very things that we felt were the only ground we had. And so it's no wonder that the practice can cause a crisis of confusion in many of us. We have to ask, what's left? What's left here? And it's important to understand that, you know, Buddhism is not meant to support our neurosis. It's meant to expose our neuroses. It's not meant to give us another ground to stand on so that we can be dependent upon something else. And this is what the Buddha is saying, I think, in the Kalama Sutta. He says, don't use scriptural references to steady yourself, because it should be doing just the opposite. It should be taking you into yourself sufficiently that you see that there's no place to steady yourself. And therefore, it exposes all of the false places, the false foundations on which we have stood. And so, true spiritual practice will be a practice in which the very neurotic and most neurotic parts of ourselves are challenged. And so there will be a lot of confusion, a lot of sense of insecurity whenever we practice a genuine path, spiritual path. And we take that crisis and we add the what we hear in the words, like, you know, this practice brings you into love and clarity and patience. And we look at ourselves and we say, I don't have that. I don't feel like I have enough of that. And from that sense of lacking, we look out and we say, well, there must be somebody in here who does. Now, it's okay as long as nobody has it. But then we see somebody acquiring it or getting it. And that throws us into even more confusion, because now we're in competition and they're getting something that I'm not. Now I'm really in self-doubt. That's why when we do retreats, we try to keep the experience level grouped in interaction during the group meetings, because if you put someone who's just beginning in a group of experienced meditators and they're talking about their insights and, oh, I'm not having that, how come I'm not having that? It just throws us back without any firm foundation to stand on. It throws us back into a neurotic pattern of self-doubting. And it's interesting because when the mind is shaken, which is what the practice is supposed to do, remember, the position that it falls most easily back to, most easily grabs hold, is the one that is most neurotic. That's where we move. That's where the membrane is the weakest. And again, it's all because there's no component strength in self-knowledge. So self-knowledge is what this practice allows for the stability and foundation to be able to understand how to work with neurotic tendencies. So this tendency that we have to find no place to stand on in ourselves with any confidence leads to questioning and dependency of others. Well, maybe he knows or she knows. Maybe I can depend upon him or her. And we look outside of ourselves for the stability rather than inside of ourselves for the self-knowledge to give us stability. And it's that constant looking outside of ourselves for our leaders, towards our leaders, towards our teachers, towards our texts, our written, anything. I mean, many of us have come to this tradition because it has 2,500 years of solid history behind it. It has a written textual canon. It has a whole monastic experience. It has people who we feel have a resonance of some depth in them behind that, and we think, okay, I'll hook myself to that. And I'll just kind of follow the teaching, kind of play with the teaching, because we really don't want to disturb ourselves in the depth of where the teaching points, which is to look at the self-doubt. We'd rather cover over the self-doubt in terms of confidence in the external. And that leads to dullness, not to aliveness. It doesn't lead to self-questioning. It doesn't lead to really considering what's going on in here. It leads to an external dependency. And spiritual scenes are rampant with that tendency. And we give more weight if somebody's written a book or somebody has a reputation, deserved or undeserved, not because what we hear resonates, but because of a reputation. See, we have to question these things. And when I say the Buddha said, everybody's like, as if we knew what the Buddha said. For the first 400 years, it was an orally passed tradition, one mouth to the next. I'll give you an equivalent. You go back 400 years in this country, you come to the first settlement in Jamestown. Now, somebody said something in Jamestown and then passed it along 400 years. Are you going to believe it? You have to question this. You can't just take this stuff straight on. You say, well, let's see now. See, that's what the Buddha is saying. This is... So believe it. Somehow, through all of those 2,500 years of history and 400 years of oral tradition, something resonates with us that says, yes, this feels right. And then we start testing that and looking at it. That's what we're doing here with his words, not just blindly following them, but this is true. Is this true for me? I mean, that's what I love about this sutta, is that it really pulls the rug out from under the Buddha. And it's, so we come to the practice with a need for dependency and with a sense of questionable confidence in ourselves, and we're asked to do the most formidable tasks that could possibly, harder than a PhD in something. We are asked to follow our breath. Impossible. And so will be sitting back there in the corners and feeling the impossibility of the task, which is impossible for all of us, with one eye open, and everybody in the room looks like they're sitting like a Buddha, except me, the chump. Oh, God, I can't do this. See, we look out. We judge to be doing exactly, staying right with the breath, never missing a single one. They're not moving. They just look like Buddhas. And then there's me. And it just throws us back into this pain, the pain of being me and never having done anything right, and the tasks are all just that feeling of being me. So, of course, the tendency would be it's much easier to conform. I'll sit still too and pretend like I'm doing it. And if I just follow the footprints of those who've gone before me, then I'll just know my way. I'll just know it. Certainly, there's a sadness in that. Because each time we step within conformity, we step out of our aliveness. We step out of our vitality, out of our uniqueness. And if this path is about anything, it's about our uniqueness. Individually unique. Unique in the sense that what someone has done before you, or the path that is right for them, will not in every detail be right for you and I. Cannot be. Someone who is etched and scarred with self-dislike will need metta, perhaps, or some other tool, but we may not. And we see somebody who has a reputation and written books proclaiming metta to be, and we'll say, oh, well, then I need to do that. And we'll do it, and it just doesn't resonate, doesn't feel like it's really, but because everyone else is doing it, we need to do it. Rather than the deep resonant of the heart, where is it, what is it that I need to do to align myself to the deepest inner urgency that I have? Where is it and what is it that I need to do that can bring out my aliveness, my vitality, and allow me to stand independently, truly independent of things, including the teacher and the texts? And I could just see the Kalamas, one teacher coming in and say, yes, follow me, you know, and don't listen to that one who's been here, she didn't know what, you know, and it's just this carousel of characters. I think if there was one salvation in my own path up until this point, has been the acknowledgement of just my own sincerity and not following I have many times stepped off of my own way into someone else's because I gave them more validity than I gave my own sense of being. But I wasn't willing or able to follow it for very long before it just didn't speak to me. It just wasn't there. It was just wasn't there. Wasn't there. There was no resonance. I mean, and it's in no way to criticize that teaching which didn't resonate with me. It just wasn't a resonant with me. When I came out of being a monk for a number of years and I came back to IMS, IMS was just getting involved through Joseph and Sharon Upandita, who is this very revered monk from Burma. And they just the whole grouping around that And it just wasn't resonating with me. It just wasn't. I had gone to Burma before. I'd spent several months there in years past, and it just wasn't resonating. So I just, no. And I got a call from someone about a retreat, and he says, oh, you must come to this retreat. And I said, well, who's teaching? And he said, Upandita. And I said, I just don't resonate with that teaching. Well, you're missing your chance of a lifetime. I said, no, I don't think so. But thank you for asking. You see, here's something that we have to know about every spiritual path. Every spiritual path has no exit, deliberately. Deliberately. Because if it did, everyone would exit and never come in. So in this spiritual path, the no exit is that what you're feeling is doubt. It's one of the hindrances. So if you're feeling doubt, you just notice it as a hindrance. Okay, doubting, doubting. Now stay on the cushion. See, that's a no exit. There's no relief. Right? And it has to be there. Or else, as soon as you had doubt and you didn't hear that as a part of the teaching, you would follow that doubt and exit. So there needs to be a no exit sign. However, there is also a time when doubt is, when the non-resonance of something is true, when it's just not resonating. And you say, no, this isn't the way for me. And then what you hear from people who are doubting, but not following their own resonance, just following the tradition, is they try to bring you back into alignment with, because you, in taking your own stance and following your own resonance, you bring forth their doubt. You allow their doubt to surface by your independence. Talk to a fundamentalist sometime. You bring out all this ire. And why? Because you're in your confidence, their doubt is arising, and they have no way to handle doubt. So it's a clash. It's interesting. I've been in scenes like that where I'm leaving. Oh, it's your ignorance. You're just leaving because you're ignorant. Well, it throws us, if you're sincere, you go into it and look at that, and it hurts. Because I don't know, maybe it is just my ignorance. I don't know, but this isn't working. And so you don't say, no, it's not my ignorance. Maybe it is, I don't know, but this isn't working, so I've got to go. And you step out, and you leave. And you just get, I got mail, hate mail. And you read this, you know, where is that coming from, you see? And you go back and you say, when you know these qualities are unskillful, these qualities are criticized, when they aren't for the good and well-being of all beings, you look at this mail and you say, that's not for the good. That's not for the good and well-being of all people. And you see, that's where you fall back. In the middle of that crisis, you don't have any, perhaps any place where you can stand and say, no, it's not my ignorance, but you know that what's coming at you is not the truth, because it carries no warmth. It carries no heart in its message. And I'm not following something that doesn't have heart. Why follow anything that doesn't have heart? That's where we're coming from. Why would we go back in that direction? So if it has heart, okay. So that's one way that doubt can express itself in terms of dependency, in terms of looking outside oneself for the answer. Another way it can turn is that it just debunks the whole practice. I am doubting, so it's not me that's wrong or at odds. It's no good for me. See? this isn't any good. This thing's not worth a darn. Why are those people sitting like that? This is stupid. It isn't worth doing. See, that's the neurotic projected outward, the neurosis projected outward. Yes? That was the Kalama's predicament. And when we become intolerant of differences, when we cannot tolerate somebody following their own true resonance, we know we are being dependent upon the practice, or upon some thought, or something, some way, some structure, some scripture, something. We're leaning into it. We're not independent. We're not surviving independently. And you begin to see that traditions, including this one, breed sameness. To just do something rote without questioning the validity of what we're doing is just sameness. Sometimes I'll go on long retreats and teach them and just see people sitting and walking not from vitality or liveness, but just like the schedule is there and this is what I'm supposed to be doing. And that somehow salvation is at the end of all of this doing. You see, if we do that, we are then fostering more self-doubt. We're just encouraging the same conditioning from whence we come. And when we throw it in the middle and say, okay, let me look at this thing. Let me critically ask questions. Let me take this thing apart. Buddha, you get in the middle too. I mean, you read the scriptures, he's supposed to be 32 feet tall, earlobes touching his shoulders, lotus blossoms on his feet. And then, when you do make it your own, you don't care whether if the Buddha were to come in and say, Rodney, hate to tell you, but you've been practicing wrong. I'd say, okay, well, if you moved a little bit to the right, Buddha, I can see the rest of the people and I'll continue to teach. Because then it's unshakable. It's not dependent upon him. It's not dependent upon the text. It's dependent upon what has been integrated into one's life. And that's unshakable. Unshakable. And then when you have that self-confidence, you see why there's no exit. But then you also realize that there's always an exit. Yes, when I'm in doubt, okay, I can hold that. It's a mind state. I know mind state. I'm doubting. Okay. And self-doubt. Okay. Right? All right. So, here I am. Well, then it doesn't mean anything. It's not pointing to anything. And we can see, you know, that when it's not seen for what it is, it's like we act it out. Because when we feel self-doubt and we hear words like awakening, or God, well, again, we don't see that. We don't see any qualities of that idealism in me. And therefore, I have to create a bridge to cross. We've created a huge cavern that has to be crossed in order to get to awakening. And because we believe firmly in the self-doubt, as we begin to practice with our self-doubt, we really reinforce it, and the distance gets reinforced. And now it's not just about this lifetime, but 1,000 lifetimes, 10,000 lifetimes. When it's here, when it's accessible to each one of us now, now, how could I make such a statement as that? Because self-doubt is the absence of self-love, love. And nothing will ever be seen or acclaimed, owned, without self-love. And self-doubt will never allow us to be finished. And we look for proof that we really aren't the self-doubting person, that we need some proof to take us out of our self-doubt. So I need some proof. I need some experiment, some experience. And then at the end of that experience, my self-doubt will be eliminated, and then I have crossed the bridge and the cavern is together. Except that no experience can touch self-doubt. Because the hole is there, and you can't fill it by just having an experience. It's like feeling unworthy and somebody's praising you. You just don't think they've seen who you really are. Thank you very much for the praise, but you don't believe it, because what you believe is the pain of what you're feeling, because that's where your beliefs really are, is that I'm unworthy and doubting. And so there's no way to have an experience to cover over the hole that we feel. So self-doubt just continues, no matter what experience we have, to generate more activity, because we aren't holy enough yet to have arrived. And we've been practicing 5 or 10 years, and we hear all these things like the cultivation of love, and where's love? Because it's not quantifiable. What's awareness? Show me. Where on the meter I stand on the scales, I don't see my awareness adding any weight to the scales. Love is not something I can take off my back and show everybody how 30 years of practice has allowed me all of this. I have no degrees, no certificates. I have nothing quantifiable to show anyone. And so if I'm into having proof, there isn't any. Oh, yes, there are changes that occur, and yes, I become kinder, but I just kind of, you know, I don't really think that that's changing. I've just softened a little bit, released a little bit of tension, but nothing inside has really changed much. So the journey is the journey to acknowledge where we stand now, and not be driven by the pain of the unacknowledged. If I stand and I am quiet, then whatever is driving me stands with me. And this is where I stand. This is the practice. If I am doubting and it's dependent and I need props and support and teacher, I need to stand in the center of that self-doubt. I need to stand right in the middle of that. I had a person who's a long-term yogi at IMS come up to me. Long-term yogi. I mean, years. Come up to me. What should I do, Rodney? Should I go here? Should I do that? Not seeing that those questions were being driven by her own doubt. She just faced what was closest at hand. That would be where she should go. The location is extraneous. What's needed is what is driving us. That's where we need to stand, where the pain is. Okay, I'm doubting. Okay, let me look at that. Now I'm no longer being driven by that. The cavern, the idealism, the crevasse between the awakening gets very small at that point. Now, all of a sudden, the now is not 20 lifetimes away. After I cover over the whole of my doubt, now all of a sudden, standing in the middle of the pain, the resonance of stillness is present. The pain never meant anything. I had been driven by it, but it never meant a thing. It was because I was afraid to go into it that I kept leaning on texts and scriptures and teachers and the Buddha. But in that, I can stand. Okay, I'm hurting. Okay. You see, that's self-knowledge. Self-knowledge is the knowledge that says that everything is workable. Everything is just what it is. I'm not going to make anything more out of anything than just what it is. Self-doubt is a belief, not a fact. As soon as we make self-doubt our meditation, when we feel ourselves self-doubting, it has no hold on us whatsoever. And all of its messages end. So the question, what attitude am I resting on in my practice? What attitude am I resting on in my practice? Because that's what's driving us. That's what's making this journey so long and laborious. That's what's making it so hard. What if I didn't do anything? I don't have to work it out. I don't have to do anything. I just have to meet it. Then we know the Buddha's teaching. Then the problem is solved. And regardless of how life or groups come at you, because you're standing there in the throng of 100 other people and you're walking out of the room and everybody is telling you how ignorant you are, how stupid, how you could be so blind not to see this perfect master, it doesn't move you. Because we know ourselves well enough not to move. Can we sit for a minute or two?